comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors.
And welcome to the Kevin Smith Show, whoever you are, wherever you are, all around this beautiful place we call Earth. Thank you for being here at the Kevin Smith Show. Welcome to talk radio like nowhere else on Earth. We're here because you have a right to know and you matter. Have you read my latest article that's on, I've posted it on the website. It's already published on the website. It's called Something Big Going On at Giza. Have you read that yet? Well, there is indeed something big going on at Giza, and you need to know about it. In this article, I give you a list of 8 events, very significant, very mysterious events that have taken place at the Giza Plateau in Egypt since 2010. So, even though the pyramids are there, this is not ancient history. The pyramids are, but these events have taken place since 2010. And these 8 events, when taken together, show a pattern that seems to indicate that something very, very big, very secret, very mysterious is currently underway at the Giza Plateau. So if you haven't read it yet, be sure you check it out. You'll see the link to the article. Again, it's called Something Big Going On at Giza. And you'll see that link in the left column on my website. Right under that picture that's the ad about joining the members area, right under that is where you'll see that link. So take the time to check that out. We have a free weekly newsletter, and this free weekly newsletter has been in existence since the year 2000. So it's been around about 11 years. And would you believe we have some people who subscribed 11 years ago that are still subscribed to the K-Files? So it must be pretty good. Most people that subscribe stay with us forever, but you don't have to. If you subscribe, and it's free, it's absolutely free, no strings attached. If you subscribe, you can unsubscribe anytime you decide to do so. It's as easy to unsubscribe as it is to subscribe. So you're not locked in, and we don't share that email list with anybody. You know, we don't rent it out, we don't sell it, we don't lease it, we don't let anybody borrow it. Okay, it's just for the K-Files. So if you're not getting the K-Files, you need to go to my website, and you'll see where it says K-Files right in the middle of the screen. Well, what you need to do is click that link and subscribe. You're going to get a confirmation email, and it has a link in it that you have to use to activate your subscription. If you don't activate your subscription, then you're not subscribed. Okay? It's a 2-step process, but you can do it in a matter of seconds. The only question we ask is, what's your email address? And then that's it. And you get the confirmation email and you activate it. What does the future look like? We're going to be talking about that. And welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening is a rising star, and we're very glad to have him with us. His name is Ian Fidel, and Ian has a pretty interesting background. We'll talk about that in just a moment, but let me tell you, he is the author of a book called Breathing Space, and this thing is making waves. People are talking about this all over the internet, and it has already won awards. It's gotten rave reviews. It's headed straight to the top. Ian Fidel, welcome to the Kevin Smith Show.
Thank you very much for having me, Kevin.
Ian, your background, I said, is pretty interesting. And let me clue the folks in on this. You've been a stockbroker. You've been a caretaker for special needs children. You've been a postal employee. Now you're a full-time writer. And Breathing Space is your first novel. And it's the first in what is a planned trilogy of novels. Got two more that come out. I think one is going to be called Resistance, and one is called Revelation.
Revelation
2132. And your book Breathing Space has already begun to win awards, and people are talking about this all over the internet. That must feel pretty special.
Absolutely. I mean, this is a dream come true.
Ian, let's talk about dreams come true. Because the premise of your book, if I've understood it correctly, is that you take all the problems that we have here on Earth facing humanity right now, don't solve them, just let them continue into the future. Many generations later, people are having to deal with the inevitabilities and the consequences of not having addressed and not having solved these problems. And it's a science fiction book that takes us into that future and kind of lets us experience that world as they will experience it if we don't address and solve some of these issues. Was this like, and I'm quite serious in asking this, how did you come up with this plot line? Was it like a bad dream you had?
Well, it's been a combination of things, but overall, I think it's just been a frustration of our neglect for Mother Earth. And I can remember years and years ago when people were talking about, oh, by the year 2000, we're going to have electric cars in every driveway. And we still haven't seen that. Albeit from corruption or just sheer laziness and being used to the way things always are. So I just wanted to get this out there, not only for the science fiction aspect, but I also wanted to let people become aware how important our environment is so we don't have to face a future of breathing space.
Well, you know, taking on issues in science fiction is something that has been done before. Not quite in this way, but Star Trek used to address some social issues from time to time, and they did it with that futuristic science fiction setting. There are some issues like that are addressed even in Star Wars, and certainly in Avatar. And the reason I bring that up is because it seems that, you know, some of the best writers, some of the best, some of the people best at conceptualizing and then communicating the concept are science fiction writers. And I think that's one of the reasons, not the only reason, but it's one of the reasons we are seeing a lot of the old Star Trek technology that was so very futuristic is becoming commonplace now. It's coming into reality and some of it becoming commonplace. I think it's because the writers were able to conceptualize and then communicate so well that concept, and it caused a bunch of people with scientific minds to sort of perk up and say, well, why not? Why the heck not? Let's see if we can. And so they have in many cases. Now, in your novel, Breathing Space, we've got these tremendous ills of the earth, bad situations that are happening. We've got extraterrestrials. We've got humans. What else have we got in there?
Well, one thing for sure, you have a lot of twists and turns. Unlike a lot of the science fiction that I've read or some of the movies even I've read, there's always the same predictable ending where the good guy wins and everything's fine. The guy gets the girl. Well, real life, that doesn't always happen. And that was one of the other reasons why I decided to write this novel. Not that I'm saying it's not going to happen, but you can expect a lot of... You could basically expect the unexpected with my trilogy series. And there's also a lot of different types of atmospheres that you'll see when you go to different planets throughout the trilogies. But on this one particular planet where the team does find a place that's habitable for mankind, you'll see giant elephantoids, vast oceans, large rainforests, but the most impressive thing that you could actually see on the planet is a cluster of pyramids and the creators of those pyramids that populate that planet.
All right, now let's dig down into this a little bit. You know, you chose science fiction as the venue to address these issues. But there's a lot of different There are a lot of different sets, I guess you could say, that you could use for science fiction. You chose, the sort of space travel and aliens and things like that. Why? What is it about that attracted you and made you want to write about it?
Well, it all actually goes back to when I was a 7-year-old child. I remember when my parents took me to see a little movie called Star Wars.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, my love for writing and the interest in writing about space and what's out there all stemmed from that. I can remember getting home from the movies that night and looking up at the stars. I was wondering, was there a Darth Vader and Luke Skywalker fighting for control of the universe? And just really wanted to know what's out there. And ever since that age, I've become interested in learning about space and what's out there, as well as writing about it. I mean, I started off when I was a youngster writing short stories, and I would hand them into my English teacher in junior high school, and he always encouraged me to continue writing. And it's a passion that I lost along the way. Life gets in the way, work, children, marriage, things like that. But ultimately, I'm very happy to find my way back to my first true love.
Have you ever personally seen a UFO?
Me personally, no. But I truly believe, I mean, if you look at all the reports of UFO sightings and abductions, even if just one of them is true, then that pretty much says that there is life outside of the outside of Earth. And, you know, I firmly believe whether it's highly advanced life or... You know, just a simple form of life, whether it be just some type of parasite even that's alive out in space. There is life other than us, and I truly believe that.
You know, you brought up a very good point, and I've said this before. How many elephants does it take to prove there are elephants?
Exactly.
One. You know, how many spacecraft that are not from Earth does it take to prove they exist? Just takes one. Now, you were a stockbroker. You also worked at the Postal Service. You were a caretaker for children with special needs. And I don't know what else. You may have done a thousand other things. Have you ever had conversations with fellow workers in any of these places about your thoughts that there's life out there? Have you ever talked to fellow workers about that?
Well, I've spoken with some people at previous jobs that were also into science fiction.
Mm-hmm.
We would also watch a lot of documentaries about UFO abductions, and they weren't as convinced as I was, but I would definitely, you know, have conversations about it with family members as well. And it just seems that we're in the grand scheme of things, how big space really is, it's kind of silly to think that it's just us and that's it. So I've had talks with fellow employees and family members about this.
Well, my follow-up question for that was this. Was it received well, or was, you know, there a lot, was there a lot of chuckle in their response when you talked about it?
I mean, when you're talking at the water cooler with other people, you know, just talking about a show that was coming on, talking about UFOs, and you did have some people in the background chuckling, and you did have others who truly did believe, and it's just a matter of, like you said, how many elephants does it take of just one day them showing up on our doorsteps in the middle of the afternoon, something like out of Independence Day, and everybody actually seeing it. But just because you can't see something, it doesn't mean that it's not there. And like we said before, if you just have one person that is correct in, you know, their claim of a UFO sighting or an abduction, then that's, you know, proof enough right there.
Yeah. You know, I've always wondered, people that chuckle, I've always wondered, honest to God, can they read?
Right. So
I mean, right? Look, you know, we had... I don't know if you've even heard of this, but at one point, the Secretary of the Air Force was General Brown. And General Brown had been active in Vietnam. And so now that he's the big boss in charge, he's at a press conference. He made a statement in response to somebody's question, where he said that the Air Force had engaged in battle a couple of times in Vietnam with these UFOs.
Right.
Now, he said that, and it was reported, and, you know, I just wonder, you know, a general of the Air Force, the guy who's running the Air Force at that point, he says they exist, and we've done battle with them. What does it take to convince people? You know, I just wonder. All right, now look, what I'd like for you to do is sort of give us a little bit of a thumbnail sketch of what people are going to find when they open your book and read it.
Okay, well, as we said before, Breathing Space does deal with modern-day ecological issues, but it amplifies it tenfold. The book takes place in the year 2095, and as we said before, if you look at the news or read the paper, you'll notice an increase in tsunamis, earthquakes, and man-made disasters, even such as the oil spills that we had. And it's funny because some of my readers have called me a visionary, while others think I have little gray aliens whispering in my ear about future events. But in the book, some people are just so affected by Earth's poor atmosphere that they're forced to wear oxygen masks during the day. And in the year 2095, actually it was in before that, in 2078, scientists predicted that within a few decades, a century at most, Earth would no longer be habitable. Now, all of these reasons, plus the Third World War, were causes for the U.S. as well as other world powers to search for a new world that could support human life. And the space colonies that we do have on other planets, they're not self-sufficient, and they can never support a large amount of people. And the story does focus around Earth Space Station Commander John Lewis. He was a veteran of the Third World War, and he's respected by his crew, but he's also a man that's plagued by memories of Earth and the loved ones he lost during the Third World War. So throughout the book, he does go back and reflect on those times, or he has bad dreams and reflects on those times. But basically, to wrap it all up, after 17 years, one of the faster-than-light U.S. probes discovers the planet that, like I said, was teeming with elephantoids and other ferocious animals. But the biggest surprise that everyone can expect is the video that one of the older probes does capture, and that's the pyramids and the creator of those pyramids. Now, the good news is that the planet's atmosphere is almost identical to Earth's, but the problem is it's a 0.02% untraceable element found in the planet's composition, and that's the reason a team is formed to explore the planet and see if the atmosphere can support human life. But the adventure really begins when the team makes it to the planet and they go on these great hunts, encounter these ferocious beasts. They go on sailing trips on great oceans, and best of all, they not only encounter the primitive pyramid builders, but they also encounter the Greys, who reveal much about mankind's past and future. And if anyone would like to find out some more, they're going to have to read the rest of the book.
Okay. But let me ask you this. Mm-hmm. What prompted you to put pyramids into this? Do they play a big role in this?
Yes. Well, without giving too much away, I was going for that shock factor kind of at the end of Planet of the Apes when Charlton Heston's riding along the beach and he sees the Statue of Liberty. Well, yeah. I was hoping eventually one day to make this into a film and have the probe scanning across the landscape and see a cluster of pyramids. I mean, imagine you're working for NASA and you see all of a sudden these cluster of pyramids and these primitive beings scattering about as the probe flies overhead. Without giving up too much, the pyramids pretty much are a history lesson for us. They're not just on our planet, but they're on other planets as well. And there is a reason why the pyramids were to be built on these planets.
Well, it's interesting that you bring up the pyramids in your book. And it's interesting to me. It's a little bit of maybe coincidence, maybe synchronicity, that we're talking about pyramids here, because I just published an article. I've done a series of shows on the Giza Plateau, and I just published an article about something big is happening at Giza, and it is. Something really big is going on, and I don't know if you've heard about this, but there are four previously unexplored tunnels inside the Great Pyramid. These tunnels are small, and they lead away from the King's Chamber and away from the Queen's Chamber. Well, they just recently put a robot into one of these tunnels, and it had a camera on it, and they were shocked. They were absolutely shocked, because these are small tunnels, but the walls and the door are polished, so it's not just leftover space. It was intended for some use. It was important. And the walls and the floors have some kind of markings on them in red paint, and they called them hieroglyph-like markings, yet to be decoded. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. We're talking with Ian Fidel, and we're talking about his book. Boy, it's apparently a real blockbuster book. It is called Breathing Space. And as we went away for break, Ian, I had just told about this tunnel that they found in the Great Pyramid that has these strange markings inside. They say they are hieroglyph-like. Okay, I found that to be very interesting language.
Absolutely.
Because these pyramids are sitting in Egypt, and hieroglyphs were invented and used in Egypt. And these are Egyptologists in Egypt. If they can read, Egyptologists in Egypt can read hieroglyphs like you sit down and read a newspaper. But they can't read these. That means they're not hieroglyphs. There's something else. They've been telling us this pyramid was built by Khufu, Pharaoh Khufu. They can read the hieroglyphs from the time of Pharaoh Khufu. Well, here's the pyramid they say he built, and it's got something written in it that's not, it's not hieroglyphs. It's some other language. They have yet to decode it. So anyway, I just find, you know, that to be absolutely fascinating because, you know, you're a science fiction writer, and I'm sure in preparation for writing this, you read all kinds of theories that people have about ancient astronauts and so forth. And, you know, one of the theories is that these pyramids at Giza were not built by the Egyptians, that they were built by somebody else. Now, on this alien planet that is found by one of these faster-than-light probes, on this alien planet, they discover pyramids. And they discover the primitive people, I suppose remnants of the society that originally built the pyramids. And they also find the Greys. Is there any particular reason that you chose to use the Greys, say, as opposed to reptilians or human-looking extraterrestrials? Any special reason why you chose the Greys?
Absolutely. Really, from most of the research I've done, the reports of abduction have been reports of Greys. And if you look a lot of the movies and the TV shows, you could even, we were talking about the hieroglyphic-like writings that are on the pyramid walls. If you go even further back into time, you can see on the cave walls these primitive cavemen that draw these beings pretty much that look like Greys. So it seems as almost they're trying to tell us a story, and I figured it was on our cave walls all the way back before the Egyptians. Why not just bring the Greys into my story as well? So that's pretty much the main reason why I chose the Greys. But throughout the trilogy, you'll meet other alien races as well, some friendly and unfortunately some not so friendly.
So this is a story of the humans getting out and around the galaxy to find a new home. And in the process, they run into all different kinds of species of alien beings, and some, as you say, are friendly and some not so friendly. It's very similar to what the early explorers experienced when they crossed the ocean and came to the New World. They ran into some people that were friendly to them. They ran into some that were way less than friendly. Breathing Space, the title, I assume that it refers to the fact that the Earth, the atmosphere on Earth, is running out of its ability to sustain life. Is that right?
Yes, that's one of the reasons. And it also talks about in the book the population has grown, and we're also looking for a little more breathing space. So it has different meanings for different people.
Okay. Are you an activist, or have you been an activist in any of the environmental causes around the country?
Well, other than my own household, which I, you know, try and teach my children, turn the water off if you're not using it, shut the lights, save energy. I have been reaching out to environmental friendly organizations with the hopes of forming a partnership where if they could maybe put a link to my website and they could, or people could order my book through their website, I would be happy to donate a portion of the proceeds to that to that organization, one of them being Rainforest. There's a bunch of them. I'm reaching out to WWF. It's hard getting out to them, but I'm hoping being on shows like yours will give me a voice and maybe one of them would reach out to me.
Well, how important, I mean, I know you use the environment as a plot for your book, but how important is it to you personally? I mean, Is this something that to you is a really big thing, or is it pretty much a plot line for a book?
Well, I'd say it's a big thing to me, and if you ask any of my family members, my children especially, I'm always on top of them about that. But I'm hoping to use the plot line into my book to bring awareness about the environment, as well as give me a voice to reach out to these organizations where I'm more than happy enough to do my part, not just so much with donating portions of the book proceeds to the charity, but also where I'd be willing to go to speaking engagements or do whatever I can to help bring awareness to just how important Mother Earth is to everybody.
Well, you know, this is the first time you've been on the show, and you probably don't know anything about me, but I am as far from a tree hugger as you can get.
Right, right.
Okay, I'm just not a tree hugger. But at the same time, I'm very, very pro-environment, because you've only got one planet, and once you destroy that, you're finished, you know?
Exactly.
You know, we're pumping literally billions, and I mean billions of tons of toxins into the air all over the earth every year. Now,
and we know it's bad, and we keep doing it.
Yeah, and, you know, people don't seem to understand, we're breathing that stuff. It's not good for us. And this whole debate about global warming, whether it's real or not real, whether it's man-made or not man-made, is a moot point. It doesn't even matter. When you breathe all these toxins, you're poisoning yourself. Regardless of whether there's global warming or not, you're poisoning yourself. And you're poisoning your water and your soil, because that stuff comes right back down onto the earth when it rains. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've said many times on this show, I'm not a tree hugger, but for goodness sake, you don't have to be. It's insane to kill the planet. We don't have another one we can go to. And that brings up this question. Mm-hmm. In your book, they have the time, they apparently have the resources to develop this technology whereby they can travel to the distant star systems and distant planets and so forth, and they go in search of another Earth that they can live on. Do you really think something like that could happen? Do you think the politicians would ever turn loose of enough money to make that happen?
Well, one of the parts of the book, it does, when the main character is asking his friend who's higher up in the government about those type of issues, his friend tells him, let's just keep it between ourselves, but it really doesn't cost $5,000 for a hammer that the government pays. The government has a lot of different ways to hide money and put it in, you know, in different types of projects that it chooses to do so. So, absolutely, I mean, I'm not saying it's, you know, absolutely sure, but I think there's a lot of things our government doesn't fill us in about, maybe for our own good, maybe not, but that's one of the parts. Actually, it's funny you bring that up. That does happen in the book, where they talk about the different ways that the government, you know, can hide money.
Well, we've had guests on this show that have said, yes, that is exactly how it's done. You know, a $5,000 hammer, a $2,000 nail, you know.
Yeah.
It really doesn't cost that, and so these cost overages go into the black ops and the black programs where they develop secret technology. One of the questions that science fiction people get asked a lot, and look, you know, Dean Haglund, he played the lone gunman in X-Files. He was the computer geek that had the long blonde hair.
Right.
All right, that's Dean Haglund, and he's been a guest on this show a number of times. And people ask him, you know, about how much, because the X-Files presented some stuff that really hit close to home on a lot of stuff, on a lot of issues. And people ask him, how much inside information did the science fiction writers for the X-Files have? Were they getting inside information? So let me ask you, and people have said this about Gene Roddenberry as well. They thought he was getting inside information. Were you made privy to any inside information about our technology and ability to get out there and explore the stars?
To be honest with you, I'm just a regular guy with an imagination and who's knowledgeable and has watched and read a lot of about what I write about. So as far as getting any secret information, I haven't been told any secret information, but I definitely have my own theories and my thoughts and beliefs of information that's not made known to the public.
Mm-hmm. So, let me get your opinion on this. What do you think about shows like The X-Files? Do you think they were getting inside information?
You know what? Anything's possible. I like to give a lot of credit to the writers and just think that they have the imagination to come up with these different scenarios, different plots, but it's hard to say either one way or the other, but I would hope that the writers had their own creative abilities without getting the inside information, but I wouldn't put it past them either.
You know, when we look at X-Files was pretty fantastic. But X-Files was not original where Star Trek was. Star Trek was breaking new ground that hadn't been broken. And so X-Files, well, they broke some new ground, but as far as the information goes, a lot of that information had been out there in various forms. Now, you're kind of breaking some new territory here because you're getting into faster than light travel. Yes, there are there are movies that deal with it. Certainly Star Trek dealt with it, full ahead warp 9,
right.
Prepare to jump to hyperspace, yeah. And so forth. That's been out there. But what you've got is you've got the humans with this magnificent technology and possessing it, yet living on a planet that is dying and it's unsustainable when it comes to human life. So they're not just out going where no man has gone before. They're going looking for a place to pitch a tent. We'll be back, folks, right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show, and my guest this evening, Ian Fidel. And Ian, I was saying as we went to break, in all of the previous, like Star Trek and Star Wars, and they're going out basically to explore, to discover, or to conquer. You've got them going out to survive. And I can't say that nobody else has done that, but it is it's not a theme that gets done very much in sci-fi, because most of the sci-fi, especially the movies, are all wrapped up with special effects and lots of things exploding, and so you have discovery, but going forth to conquer as well. Do your explorers encounter any battle situations along the way?
They do when they reach the planet, and they don't actually battle. But they battle, I want to say, like ferocious animals. There's an elephant hunt in one of the scenes that seems to be going well, but then all of a sudden the predators of those elephants charge in, and that's when the humans bring out their advanced technology compared to the primitive beings that are on that planet and join in the battle to join forces with their allies.
These elephants, are they, I mean, do they just look like regular elephants, only they're giants, or are they somewhat different?
They have the same form, they have the four legs, same form as an elephant, but their tails are wider and longer. They move a lot slower than the elephants. They're pretty much walking targets for predators, but they have a large amount of numbers of them, so there's not much of a defense for them except their sheer size and numbers.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they're prickly brown hair, and you'll see throughout the book when they're on the planet, there's talks of them being hunted for their, just like the cavemen pretty much did, hunted for their meat, hunted for their fur, so they could use as jackets and things like that for different changes in weather.
Mm-hmm. How many planets do they visit?
Well, in this first book, they actually go to the planet Exodus that the probe did discover. But throughout the trilogy, they'll be going to different planets to try and convince other races to join them in a fight that you'll find more about in book one.
Mm-hmm. You know, NASA has a mission, a program ongoing right now that is in search of other Earths that are habitable. And they actually have found some. They're all in the constellation Cygnus. And they have discovered 170 solar systems in Cygnus that have multiple planets around them. And when you add up all those planets in those 170 systems, that's 408 planets. So far, they have found about 50 that are habitable. However, there's no way to get there from here.
Right, that could be a problem, right?
Yeah.
Now we know of it, at least.
Yeah, now, is this, in your book, this ability to travel these great distances at faster than light speed, is that a new ability, newly acquired in your book, or is it something that is presumed to have been around for a while?
Well, it's definitely something that is kept secret that the general public doesn't know about, because that's one of the questions that the main character does ask his friend, who is higher up in the government, that question. He lets him know that it's not known to the general public, but this technology has been around for quite some time, and even though they're close friends, he can't give him too much information about it. But just to give you a little hint, mankind has been given a lot of help over the years from its infancy all the way up until the year 2095. And we've been getting a lot of help along the way, whether it be from cures to diseases that man has suffered, different types of inventions. So there is some help that we've received. I'm not going to say which race, but that we did receive to be able to reach these different speeds.
You know, one of the big, big theories that people have been working on for a long time has to do with gravity and the manipulation of time-space via gravity waves. And they are getting very, very, very close to being able to do that. And if they can, if they achieve it, and, you know, when I say they're getting close, that's the scientists that are out there in the public domain where we know what they're doing. They're getting very close. So it probably means that in the black projects, they've already done it. They say that the real state of our technology is anywhere from 50 to 200 years more advanced than what the public is aware of. So it's possible we've already got it. Now, you're writing this book. It is science fiction. But how much of it would you say that you ascribe to, in other words, or subscribe to, how much would you say, you know, that's really probably going to happen?
I'd say a good portion of it. I mean, if you look at all of the secrecy behind Area 51, it doesn't, you know, it doesn't leave me to believe that we don't already know how to manipulate time and space. But in the book, you'll see that when they encounter the Greys, they pretty much let everybody know what their part has been with mankind over the years. And I think you'll be pretty surprised.
Is there any part of this book where we see, you know, almost every movie there's some sort of love interest in the movie? Do we have that in this book?
Yes. Actually, the main character, John Lewis, he reflects throughout the book about the true love of his life that happened when he was on Earth. But as the book continues, he does find another love interest as he tries to let go of his past and the loved one he had on Earth. And he starts having feelings that he hasn't had in a long time for one of his crew members. And I've been getting a lot of compliments from people that aren't very big into science fiction, but they said, I'll read it because I'm your friend, or they pass it on to someone that might be interested. And they said they really fell in love with the characters, the romance. Sometimes the captain will have a comedic dialogue with some of his crew members, just to show that he's a regular person like everyone else. So throughout the book, you will see the torment that he goes through, remembering life on Earth and those he lost, and as he deals with the feelings of falling for someone new.
Okay, now they're in space for a great long time, I would assume.
Well, when they're on the station looking for a new planet to find, they sign up for tours, and John Lewis is military and some of the station is civilian, so it's a voluntary basis where he could go back to Earth, but because the memories are so painful, he chooses to re-enlist and stay on Space Station Triton. So he's been up there for 17 years, and he doesn't really want to have to come back to Earth, but there's a situation that arises where he has to face his demons and go back to Earth before heading to the new planet.
You know, this is one of the very real world problems that's going to have to be faced as we step off of this planet, if we ever do. Well, I shouldn't even get started on that. But anyway, if we ever go back into the space business, there's some very real world problems we have to face out there. All right, we'll be back right after this.
United Kingdom, and you are listening to the fantastic Kevin Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening, Ian Fidel. And Ian, where I was headed before we had to step away for break was this. In order for there to be any serious space exploration by humans, you have to have humans that are in space for long periods of time. There are physical problems that NASA and other agencies have been working on about how to overcome those physical problems when you spend so long out in near zero gravity. But not just the physical problems. There's a whole sociological thing that has to take place for people to adjust to living with each other, very, very vulnerable out there in the cosmos. and they're living with each other on this space station or huge spaceship. So there have to be some sociological adjustments that they make, and it takes on its own culture. It's no longer the same as the culture of Earth. So I would think after a while, you would have people that are very, very different from their point of origin, which was Earth. I would think also that you would have a lot of problems that come up just from living with other humans in a confined space out there in the cosmos. Do you have any of that sort of thing going on in your book?
Well, one of the ways that I was able to deal with that was when the team actually leaves Earth to go to the new planet, the technology that we've had, even though it's 17 light years away, we're able to make it there in 6 months. So the ride over there, the humans, and they also have a chimp on board also, almost acts as a mining canary, are put to sleep, and they have electrodes put on their body to help with atrophy, and all their nutrients are supplied through these various different tubes as well as excretions. So for the most part, even though it's 6 months, but they're asleep most of that, and they are awakened just before getting to the planet. So I was able to work around that issue for the ride over there.
Mm-hmm. Your lead character has been in space for 17 years, you say?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
He's also a veteran of the Third World War, and one of the reasons he was able to become captain was because the mental capacity, how strong he is mentally, not just physically, but mentally as well, to sustain different situations and extended time pretty much in space.
All right. Now, you one of the Star Trek series, we had an officer, and I can't remember her name, but she is a sensitive and a counselor. Counselor Troy, that was her name. So her job was to sense when the crew were getting a little bit edgy about something, and she is their counselor. Do we have any kind of a figure like that in this crew?
Well, a lot of the times throughout when there are tragedies or situations that are a little stressful, the captain, John Lewis, takes control and diffuses a lot of the situation. But there is one other character that comes along for the ride, Katie O'Hara, who's very sensitive when it comes to taking care of the chimp, and she doesn't like the idea of him being used in the capacity he's being used. But she's a little more on the sensitive side, and then you have some other stronger personalities that come on as well. But I'd say out of it all, the mediator would be John Lewis.
What was the biggest surprise that they encountered, without giving away too much of the book? What was the biggest, the thing that surprised them the most in all of their discoveries?
Well, I'd say other than making first contact with the primitive beings, seeing the graves, I would say, was the biggest surprise to them, and hearing the history behind the graves and mankind. They weren't so aware of how close they've been in contact with mankind and their role in society. And actually, without giving too much away, they give us information letting us know that humans are not just on Earth, but there are humans throughout the galaxy and solar system as well. So that's pretty much one of the biggest surprises, I'd say, is realizing that our brethren are on different planets throughout the galaxy, and some of the evil forces that are out there hunting us down.
All right, now, I realize that this is a science fiction book. It's a novel. But there's, you've just brought up something that is a huge debate in the world of UFO enthusiasts, and that is some people think that extraterrestrials are all benevolent, and they love us, they want to hold hands and sing Kumbaya. Then there are other people in the UFO world if you will, who they think, you know, by golly, they've been abducting people. They've been mutilating animals as well. These are not friends. These are foes. They are hostile. They are malevolent. And we need to protect ourselves from them. Now, I have a different view, and my view is they're no different from us. My view is some are good guys and wear white hats, and some are bad guys and wear black hats, and some are real bad guys, and they don't wear any kind of hat, so you don't know which side they're on. They sneak up on you, and they're really bad. But you've got some good guys, you got some bad guys, and I don't think they're going to be a great deal different from us. But what do you think? What are we looking at with these extraterrestrials? Not the extraterrestrials in your book, but extraterrestrials as they actually exist. What are we dealing with?
Well, like you said, I believe some are good, some are bad. But when you talk about doing abductions and mutilating cows, just think about it. As humans, we're doing the same thing, but to animals, we're to find a good cause at the end. I mean, it might take the sacrifice of abducting some animals from their natural environment, bringing them to these laboratories, and doing different tests on them and seeing what makes them tick and what could eventually help us in the future. So in the way we perceive different lab rats and other animals we do testing on, that could be very well the same that aliens do to us. And maybe it's for our greater good that they might abduct us to do samples on us and see what kind of illnesses mankind does have, and maybe for all we know, they could be passing it down to us, the cures to those diseases, subliminally, or other different ways that they might have in contact with the government or something like that. So it doesn't, even though they're abducting people and dissecting cows, we do the same thing with lab animals. So there are some good aliens, I feel, out there, and there are some bad, but I wouldn't judge them just because of the abductions and the cow mutilations.
If someone wants to do something to me and I don't want that done, and they insist and they're going to do it, I don't care what their motives are.
Right.
You know?
He's actually one of the bad ones, right?
Well, you know, he may go to alien church and be an alien deacon and may sing in the alien choir. I don't care, as far as I'm concerned. If I don't want something done to me and he's doing that, that's my enemy. And I think if, you know, I don't know how lab rats think. I don't know if they do think, and I'm pretty sure they do. And I'm pretty sure they consider us to be hostile and malevolent because of the things we do to lab rats. And if they could shoot back, it might be a different story. You know, when we talk about them being hostile or benevolent, that's entirely, you point out something that's important. That definition of aliens is entirely homocentric. It's entirely centered on our perception of what they're doing to us and how they're interacting with us. I've talked to people who say that they have had contact with extraterrestrials and have given fairly convincing evidence that they have had contact with extraterrestrials, and they say that as far as they could tell, the extraterrestrials, when it comes to being benevolent or hostile, they basically just don't care. That's just not part of what makes them. And, you know, they've just got their thing to do, and they're doing it.
Right. And what type of emotions they have, if any at all.
Okay, now that brings up something else, the emotions of extraterrestrials. In your book, do they have emotions?
Well, the primitive ones definitely do have emotions, and you'll, as a reader, fall in love with them. But the highly advanced ones, they do have feelings towards human beings, but more of caretakers, I'd say. And they do have a lot to do with some of the things that we've experienced over the years. And I really don't want to give away too much, but there is definitely a big surprise ending with everything that culminates.
Do you see this this book becoming a movie or a TV series?
My ultimate dream is really to see the pages of this book leap onto the silver screen. I mean, I could. Everyone that's finished reading the book has told me, wow, I could picture the new planet, and I could picture the problems on Earth, the Third World War. You could see these visions, and meeting up with these different aliens and seeing, imagine like just seeing on a TV, on a movie screen, this probe going over the landscape and going across herds of different animals that are odd looking to us, and all of a sudden coming across a familiar sight, which is the pyramids. I think that would be something that would be mind-blowing. And that's my goal, is to ultimately get someone to pick this up and we could work together on that.
Do you, in your book, now you've already told us that these pyramid builders are scattered around the universe. Do you address what is the purpose of the pyramids?
Yes, absolutely. It's we don't find that out until we meet up with the Greys. And at that point, they explain the importance of the pyramids.
There are people on this planet who still don't have a clue that there's something special about pyramids, but there really is. You know, Ian, they're all over the world. They're in Asia. They're in there's a pyramid in at least one in Australia. They're in across Europe. Pyramids in the Americas, pyramids on islands. Apparently, there's some pyramids at the bottom of the ocean that were built before they were at the bottom of the ocean.
Right.
So there's got to be a purpose. Now, I know it plays a key role in your book, so you don't want to give that away. I understand that. But let me ask you this. In providing us, in the book, providing us with the answer to why the pyramids, what's their purpose, did you derive that from anything here on Earth, or is it totally something that you dreamed up for the book?
Well, I would say the reason why they're not just all over Earth but other planets was something that I totally came up with on my own. I have a true belief that we didn't have the technology back then to communicate with people that were living in North, in Egypt and Australia. So there had to be some being or that could travel to different parts of the world and for some reason tell these people or maybe even build for them these pyramids. So I just incorporated that into my book, and you'll see exactly why the pyramids were put on Earth as well as other planets throughout the universe.
All right, now this reason that that you put in the book, do you think it really fits the real situation here on Earth, or is it just fiction? I mean, I know it's fiction, but do you think it would actually fit with answering the questions for Earth and the pyramids here?
I want to tell you so bad. But, I truly believe that it could be a reason why. It's something that I definitely feel very strongly about, and when you read the book, you'll see the purpose of it. But I really do believe in that.
Well, let me tell the audience, look, if you click on Ian's picture on my website, go to kevinsmithshow.com, click on his picture, it'll take you over to his website where you can get the book. Now, tell us a little bit about this book has won an award, hasn't it?
Actually, it was nominated as a finalist for the Next Generation Indie Book Awards, and that was an event that actually took place the same day when I was at Book Expo America, which was in the Jacob Javits Center in New York City. But I did attend that award ceremony at the Plaza Hotel, And it was just an honor out of a nationwide contest to be nominated as a finalist. It was between me and three other people. So whether I sell one book or a million books, to actually just have my dream out there that other people are holding my book, what I came up with, is honor enough for me. And I'm just very excited right now. I sold my first copy to a person over in England. So I'm hoping to get this book out there worldwide, because really the Earth's atmosphere and the environment has to do with all of us collectively as a species, not just Americans or Europeans. And I really want to get that message out there, as well as entertain people and make people say, wow, that's why the pyramids are there. Things like that is what really gets me going, and really that's my motivation.
Well, you know, philosophy isn't done very often in books of philosophy. It's done in plays and novels, and these days, movies, and in music. The same is true with theology. It's how many people do you know that rush out and buy the latest book from some theologian? You know, nobody reads theology except seminarians, but theology gets done, and it gets done through movies and plays and books and music. And so, you know, having this science fiction novel as a venue is certainly a great stage to be standing on to present, you know, your views about we need to solve these problems. The people that have read it and that have commented to you after reading it, have they said anything about, hey, you know, that was a great book, and, you know, I get it about the environment. I get it about how we need to solve these problems before it gets to this point. Is it having that impact, do you think?
I believe so. Actually, just before I came on the air with you, I was at my daughter's dance recital practice. I'm going to be joining the fathers in the number, and one of the fathers actually did read my book, and he was telling the other fathers what a great story it was, and it did make him open his eyes to the importance of, you know, the environment. I mean, he always knew it, but just from this one particular story, I feel like I did touch him in some way, and I also entertained him, because he was going on for quite some time about it, that he could see this in the movies and what a great book it is. And we eventually got in trouble with the dance studio owner, but she told us we had to get back to practice. But I really do feel like just if I could touch at least one person and they could spread the word, then and I could spread my message about the importance of the environment and at the same time entertaining people, then I've accomplished my goal and a dream that I've always had, which was to be along with the Steven Spielbergs, and not that I'm saying at that level yet, but to be along them and spreading your dreams and your thoughts about the universe with everybody else. So
I touched
a few people.
I told you philosophy isn't done in philosophy books, really. That's not how the general public gets philosophy. They get it in entertainment. But let me give you a philosophy. You said you are not the level of Steven Spielberg yet. Let me tell you something. Steven Spielberg was Steven Spielberg before anybody knew Steven Spielberg. He was always at that level.
Right.
And so, you know, I don't buy that. I think, you know, you've written a fantastic book. You are at that level. And one day there will be somebody on my show, I'll be an extremely old man, and there will be somebody on my show saying, you know, I'm not at the level of Ian Fidel yet.
Right.
We're all at the level we are, and we always will be.
Right. I guess, well, going back to that 7-year-old boy that I was, I look up to what they've done, and I am a little bit, I am modest, but I see exactly what you're saying. I feel like I do have a talent, and I haven't won the awards that Steven Spielberg has won, but I'm hoping to do that one day.
Yeah. Well, you know, I don't know whether I am a good talk show host or not, and there's a level at which I don't care. I'm just me. But I've always been this, even before I was a talk show host. You see my point?
Exactly.
Yeah. All right. Now, you went to this book convention. What's it called? A book convention?
Book Expo America.
Expo. Yeah, at the Jacob Javits Center. Interestingly, my guest tomorrow night was also there.
Oh, okay.
And he's a publisher, and he's from the Netherlands. And he was there representing some of the books that his company publishes. And I heard that it was a massive book expo. Is that correct?
Absolutely. It was thousands of people there. It was such an experience. And those thousands of people, it wasn't open to the general public. It was just dedicated to publishers, representatives of publishers, booksellers, and librarians. So it was quite some turnout. I was very impressed.
Well, I was having a conversation with another person today who also went to that expo. Not this publisher. I talked to him too. I talked with another person that went to the expo there at the Jacob Javits Center, and he said, "Man, anybody that's got it in their minds that books are dead and that they're a thing of the past," he said, "let me tell you, if you could see that expo, you would realize that is absolutely not true." Okay. Our conversation then turned to some of the events happening on the planet now. And your book is about big bad things happening on the planet. One of the big bad things happening on this planet is the nuclear reactor meltdown happening in Japan. And it's not just one reactor. Some people think it's just one. That would be bad enough. It isn't. There are three of them. And our conversation turned to some of this big, big bad stuff, and I said, "Well, you know what? This idea that books are dead—if the grid goes down, which it very well could do—I mean, look, there are a lot of things that could cause our electrical grid to go down. If that happens, you won't be reading very many books on Kindle because you won't be able to recharge the battery." And you won't be reading very many on your computer because you won't have electricity and you can't recharge the battery on your laptop. Mm-hmm. And so books are kind of, they're kind of a necessity forever. So let me ask you this. Did you carry books into space? Did you carry books into these new planets in your novel? Ah, we have to get that answer when we come back from break. It just took over. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening, Ian Fidel. And Ian, when we went away for break, I had just asked you the question whether books in your novel make it into space. So I want to give you the opportunity to answer that.
Okay, well, just to go back real quickly about what happened in Japan, it's funny you brought that up about, well, not funny, but it's ironic how you brought that up about with the problem with the reactors and the tsunami in Japan. When the main character is back on Earth, he's actually reading a newspaper article that says tsunami hits Taipei. And after the unfortunate incident that happened in Japan, people told me, wow, like, this is just amazing how the coincidence from your book of what happened is happening in real life. But I just wanted to touch on that real quick. But as far as books making it into the space and throughout the year 2095, one of the parts of the book, Captain Lewis is back on Earth. and he's reading a magazine. It's actually a hunting magazine. And the pictures in the magazine, they have a computer chip in them, and the images are moving as he's reading the pages. And just to let you know also, the hunters aren't really hunting animals because a lot of them are extinct. They're hunting robotic type of deer, ducks, birds, things of that nature. But they do have magazines and books in the future, but they're advanced. They're almost like when in the Harry Potter movies when they're reading and reading an article or reading the newspaper and the images move as they read. We do it with computer chips. They do it with magic, but it's somewhere along that line.
Well, reading is a very, very important thing, and it's becoming a lost art, reading. You know, there are a lot of lots of people that have never read a book, and then they get incensed when I say something. I do. I'm rude, crude, and socially unacceptable. I'm not politically correct. I say what I think, and I talk about our population being mushrooms. They sit in the dark and eat a steady diet of manure that's fed to them by television. They don't read, and they're uninformed, and then they get upset when I tell them they're uninformed. But it's the truth. And, you know, reading is so vitally important. I work 20 hours every day, Ian, and the greatest portion of my day is spent reading, doing research for upcoming shows, and reading is important. We do a lot of it on computer now, but I don't see, really, that there's ever going to be a replacement for paper and ink books, but they may become high-tech like you've described. I think probably the technology exists where they could do that pretty soon. Of course, it wouldn't be just regular paper either. They'd have to have some kind of screen in there for the moving images. But anyway, I think it's very, very important. Now, are there children involved in this story?
In this particular book of the trilogy, there aren't any children involved, but except for the fact where the main character, John Lewis, has a very good friend who works in the government as well, and he talks about, you'll see in the book where he talks about his relationship with his grandchildren, and even though he's so high up in the government, he does have a soft side, and he is eligible for retirement, but he wants to make sure that he gets John Lewis onto this mission to find a new planet because he feels that with John there, they'll have the greatest amount of success. And he's so concerned about his grandchildren and their future to get them somewhere safe that he continues to stay at his present position. And one of his granddaughters actually is one of those unfortunate people that are forced to walk around wearing an oxygen mask throughout the day. So it does hit home with him. So that's pretty much the main part where children would be involved for this particular book.
This mission to go find a new planet where humans could live, is the mission itself top secret?
Yes, it is top secret. They actually have the place where the U.S. where the vehicle that they are traveling in. There's an alert to get everyone away from the area except for some privy personnel. And it is tightly kept secret. And even John Lewis's friend tells him, I can't even tell my wife about this because if she was ever to leak it or is known that it was leaked, people have been known to be made disappear. So it is something that is top secret and taken very seriously by the government.
Okay, so all of the people that are involved are under this oath of secrecy, I would assume. But you said that it's not all military. There are some civilians involved, right?
Yes, specialists in different fields, yes.
And so, you know, that's very much like the real world that we live in right now. A lot of the big, deep, dark secrets that all of us just sort of hear rumors about and we speculate about. But a lot of those big, deep secrets are really in the hands and the minds of a whole lot of civilians. And you've got that same situation on the on this mission. One of the things that we have in the real world of these deep, dark secrets is, whether military or civilian, there are people that decide they're going to come forward and they're going to be a whistleblower. They're going to tell what's going on. Do you have any whistleblowers in this novel?
Well, no, I don't. And one of the reasons is some people have a type of oath that they feel they want to be good Americans, and other people are just downright afraid of what would happen if they did come forward. So in this book, there aren't any whistleblowers, and some of it is because of their patriotism, and some of it is because of their fear of our government.
Okay, now, communications is a huge, huge situation. A radio wave travels at the speed of light. If you're traveling at the speed of light, your radio wave that you're sending out is just traveling alongside with you. In other words, you're traveling at the same speed as your radio wave.
Right.
Therefore, your radio wave is not going to be an effective way to communicate with Earth as you get far, far away. How do they communicate with mission control? How do they communicate with Earth?
Okay, well, basically, when they do reach the new planet, there is no communication with Earth until they could get within range to reach the space station. But the way it works out with the probe, the signal that they received, that probe was launched 17 years ago, and the signal that they're just getting back now, this whole incident of the probe finding the planet and discovering the pyramids and the inhabitants, that's basically a 17-year-old message. It took 17 years to get back to us.
Uh-huh.
So when we do get that, we don't know what to expect, really, what happened, but it was 17 years ago. But when we do get there, there is no contact with Earth until we get back closer.
Well, you know, even just communicating from here to Mars, when they send commands up for the rover on Mars or for any of the satellites that we send up there, when they send commands up, it takes somewhere around 23 minutes, something like that, for that message to get from here to Mars. And then there's a response by the computer on board, and it takes 23 minutes or so for that to get back to us. And that's just going from here to Mars, and that's our next door neighbor. And so I would think that whenever we step out finally into space again, and step out to do some serious exploration of space, they're going to have to get this communication thing modernized. Radio is very old technology, and they're going to have that modernized. I think they've done it. I think they have. I think it's quantum communications. And they're just little signals that bubble up in the news once in a while that make me think it's been done. It's, you know, it's not futuristic. What's the most futuristic thing that you threw into the mix here?
Well, I'd have to say, when we meet the Greys, finding out their means of transportation is a lot different from what got us from Earth over to the new planet. I'd say that was one of the biggest ones, as far as when we take a tour of their ship. They eventually let us take a tour with the lead Gray, and he explains a lot about their technology as they go through the ship, their means of travel, how they feed themselves, things like that. That's pretty the high tech end. You'll see when they take a tour around the ship, their propulsion systems.
Now, we've had people on this show who say they have actually been on board extraterrestrial craft. Some of those people say that you see the size of the craft before you get on board. But the instant you step through that door, it's huge in there. It's like it may be only 30 feet around or 100 feet around when you're standing outside looking at it. But when you step inside, it's like all the dimensions change, and it's huge inside. Do you have that built into the novel? Is that something you address in the novel?
Well, as they're going through the ship on their tour, it seems pretty obvious to most people that it's a large ship. When they go through the door, actually, how they even get up into the spaceship is pretty interesting. But once they're on board, they go through the different departments of their ship, and even the control room is a lot different from what we would think, what our control rooms look like. So I don't go into too much detail about how much bigger the ship is from what it looks from the outside once you're inside, mm-hmm. but they do go on a quite extended tour that would lead one to believe that it's a much bigger ship than it appears.
Are these Greys based on that planet, or are they just visitors like the humans in this secret mission?
Well, the way the Greys are presented in this book, they're the protectors of a lot of the different races out there. That I don't want to go into it too much, but that's where they also talk about the use of the pyramids, why they're so vital to the different planets throughout the galaxy. I would pretty much say that's the main issue I deal with right there.
How far do you think we are in terms of time? How far away are we from getting on a spaceship and traveling to another planet?
As civilians, for leisure?
Just Earth people.
I believe that we have the technology at this point. It's maybe just a matter of fine-tuning it. I think there's a lot we really don't know about, like especially in areas of Area 51. But I would say, when you look back in time, you thought we'd have by the year 2000 these flying cars and different types of vehicles that are.
All right, we have to step away for a break. We'll be back right after this. That was interesting. That was very interesting, wasn't it? A moment of silence. The software's still acting up a little bit. We'll have to get that addressed. I worked on it today, but it's still acting up a little bit. Ian, we're racing toward the end of the show, and I want to ask you this. You've told us that when you were a kid, you're 7 years old, you go to see Star Wars, and it had a big influence on you. What are some of the other influences on your thinking and on your writing?
Well, a lot of the shows I've seen on these different channels that talk about ancient aliens and alien astronauts, I'm glued to the TV when those come on. And I can remember even back when I was younger, in my earlier years, when we just had encyclopedias. We didn't have all the cable TV. Me and my father would actually look through the encyclopedias and read about aliens because they saw I had a big interest in it. And I'd have to say those were some of the bigger influences, just reading about and watching as of late a lot of the reports on alien astronauts and different types of theories of that kind.
Yeah, what do you think about that? When you see these shows that talk about alien astronauts, ancient alien astronauts, what do you think about that? You think it's plausible? You think it happened?
Absolutely. I mean, it was obviously something that the these people before us have seen that touched them so greatly that they felt the need to communicate, whether it's through hieroglyphics or through paintings on walls. That was their form of expressing themselves and passing the word along to the next generation so they wouldn't forget. We're not able to speak with, unfortunately, those generations that have passed so long ago. But that's their way of communicating with us, that they have seen something that that really meant a lot to them and that they felt important to share with mankind in future generations.
All right, so there's no doubt in your mind that Earth has been visited in times past by these ancient astronauts. Are we being visited now, do you think?
I still believe so. I would think that all those, like I said earlier on, all those reports of alien sightings and abductions, even if one of them is true and we're getting them all the time, I would definitely be led to believe that there are still visitations going on, whether it's for scouting purposes or just as far as trying to help us along the way and study us. I do believe that we are still getting visitations from alien beings.
You know, a lot of people think that there is an impending invasion from space. And even Stephen Hawking talked about how we really don't need to be sending communications out there trying to contact these aliens because they might not be good for us. So what do you think? You think we're ever going to be invaded from space by these aliens?
I don't put it past, I don't put anything, I never say never, basically. And in the book, you'll see the Zetans do talk about an impending type of invasion and what's happened in previous times when mankind on other planets have met alien beings that were hostile. And just to touch real quick on the invasion, when I would watch a movie like, say, Signs, for example, with Mel Gibson, I was all into it, and then all of a sudden at the end, these advanced beings that could travel these big distances throughout space are simply defeated by throwing water on them. And I'm thinking if these beings have scouted us out, scouted our planet out, they would know what their weaknesses on this planet would be, especially if they're so highly advanced. So in my book, I look for other means of help for mankind. It wouldn't be that something so simple. They would wear suits or they would figure out some other way to defeat us. But it's one of the things that sometimes irks me about books or even movies where it's just some simple reason at the end just defeats the aliens and they couldn't figure this out before they came after all the observation they've done on us and our planet.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. However, it could be something very simple, but something they didn't anticipate. But that, you know, that would only be true if they had no experience with this planet. For instance, if we went to another planet and there was some type of germ or bacteria there that we didn't know was there. In fact, it's alien to us. We didn't even know it existed. It's too small for us to see. It's too small for our satellites and probes to see. So we get over there, and something we can't even see defeats us. But in the case of Earth, these aliens have apparently been coming here for centuries, for millennia, for thousands of years. So they know what's here.
Exactly. They've been studying us and the planet, I think, long enough to know what might work for them and what, you know, would be deadly to them. So that's where I go with that.
Well, it also seems a little bit implausible that just throw water on them and it kills them. Seems a little bit implausible in that they came to a planet that's 75% water.
Exactly, right.
You know?
True.
All right. The next book up is Resistance.
Yes.
Okay. Have you started on that one yet?
Actually, I have the outline finished for books 2 and 3. I was really trying to market book 1 and get it out there. My goal was, after the Javits event at Book Expo America, to start filling in the spaces for books 2 and 3 eventually. But I do have the broad outline, and I know where actually the trilogy is going to end, and there will be a form of spirituality, I don't want to give too much away, that will end off book 2 leading into book 3. So I do have the outlines finished, and I'm very anxious to get started, but I also would like to not put too much on my plate at one time. I'd like to take one step at a time and get this book out there, and even hopefully work with someone one day on turning this into a movie.
Well, who knows? You may be the next J.K. Rowling.
I hope so. From your mouth to God's ears.
You know, no one except her believed she was going to be capable of doing this. And for those who don't know J.K. Rowling, that's the creator of the Harry Potter stories. And, you know, she was writing in public restaurants and coffee shops. And that's how she started. And she is a billionaire today. So who knows? You know, one day you may be listed as...
Happen. You just need that one break sometimes. And I'm hoping someone listening out there will be interested in maybe working with me and one day see my dream become a reality.
Well, we have a number of very well-known filmmakers, movie makers, that do listen to this show. So who knows? Maybe they'll check this book out.
That would be great, and then I could come back and talk about the making of the movie.
Yeah. And you could tell us all about how it feels to be a billionaire.
If that's the case, I would love to come into the studio personally and thank you for this opportunity.
Well, we certainly would make that possible. All right, well, Ian, stay on the telephone with me for just a moment. I have to bring this flight of the KSS Starship in for a landing. We are out of time, ladies and gentlemen. Ian Fidel, and Ian Fidel is a rising star in the world of science fiction writing, and I predict we probably will see some Ian Fidel stories, books, etc., on television and in the movies before very much longer. He's apparently got the gift. All right, that's going to be it for this evening. My friends call me Steel Eye, my enemies do too, and you can call me whatever you want. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until tomorrow. So long, everybody.